We show up in church for all sorts of reasons. On days when a warm bed and a long, leisurely breakfast tempt us almost beyond what we can bear. And one of them, I've been told, although it has never happened here, is because our parents, sometimes even our children, have come to town for a visit and will be pleased to know how active we are in our church. Except that we haven't been very active, and we're nervously hoping that nobody will come up and say, "We've missed you this year. How nice to see you again." All of which gives me an excuse to pass along how one church handled a similar problem in a small college town. It seems that a tavern, much patronized by students, ran the following ad in the campus paper during the days just before Parents' Weekend. The ad said, "Bring your parents for lunch Saturday. We'll pretend we don't know you." The campus chaplain was a very bright man who rose to the challenge and posted a revised version of that ad on the campus bulletin board. It read, "Bring your parents to chapel Sunday. We'll pretend we know you well." Now, the notes for that comment are typed on a piece of paper, so I want you to know that any similarity between this story and any persons who have ever attended this church is unintended and purely coincidental. He was the god of doors and gates in Roman mythology, represented with two faces, one looking forward and the other looking back. His name was Janus, and before we leave the month named in his honor, I want to take one last look back at some things that happened in 1992. My selection of things to remember is determined by the place where I stand at this moment and the kind of audience which has chosen, for whatever reasons, to come to church. One of the most disturbing things in 1992 was that so many wars, big ones and little ones, were started or made worse by misdirected religious passion. We like to think that we're more tolerant now than the people who launched the Crusades in the name of Christ and herded thousands of Jews into lakes to be baptized or die, and more tolerant than those defenders of the faith who burned heretics and slightly addled old people at the stake. But it's hard to look at some places featured in 92 and still feel that confidence. The terrible atrocities in fractured Yugoslavia may have started as a mix of politics and economics, but it has turned into a religious war, feeding off the strong emotions that are inflamed by stubborn, dogmatic faith. Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and Muslim partisans are all absolutely positive that their way is pure and right, and that the intentions of the other believers are demonic. If you can imagine Wichita Protestants shelling the Church of the Magdalene on Kellogg, and Catholics firebombing Temple Emmanuel, and the retaliations that might follow in a city with no law and order, you can begin to imagine the horror in Yugoslavia. Religious leaders among Serbs, Croats, and Muslims were not only far too slow to condemn the violence, they sometimes seemed to give it legitimacy, even to the ceremonial blessing of guns. I can imagine situations in which I might take a gun into my hands in self-defense, but I cannot imagine ever blessing that instrument of death. And if I did, I hope I would confess that my Christian faith had ceased to function. Jonathan Swift passed a judgment on us back in the 18th century. He said, "We have just enough religion to make us hate, but not enough to make us love one another. And we haven't changed as much as we'd like to think. Muslims and Christians fought each other last year in Nigeria, the Sudan, Azerbaijan. Hindus and Muslims were killing and maiming each other by the thousands in India. Catholics and Protestants kept right on blowing one another up in Ireland, as they've done for as long as some of you can remember. These things happen because religious leaders teach their followers from childhood to be exclusionist in their faith. We're right, the others are wrong, and from there it's only one short step to hatred." I cannot imagine a more crucial need than for churches which are inclusive rather than exclusive, which remind us that we have to learn to live with uncertainty, and which rejoice in diversity instead of trying to suppress it. One of our missions, one of our most sacred missions as a congregational church, is to be a model of inclusion. Glad, not just willing, but glad to worship each Sunday with a room full of people like this one, who grew up Catholic, Mennonite, Quaker, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, Unitarian, Church of Christ, Baptist. We live together, as the world must learn to do, by making good use of our differences instead of separating to be with those who never disagree with us. No matter what the issues are that divide people, abortion, gay rights, gender discrimination, immigration limits, churches were meant to address them courteously, never in ugly and reciprocal hatred. Vulgar signs, taunting language, disruptive violence, these are not the methods that match the Spirit of Christ. Some of us, I would guess, may need some special help to hold on to that spirit. If Mr. Randall Terry and his friends come back to Wichita this summer, as they have threatened, to find new targets for their rigid judgments about who is Christian and who is not. Another profoundly disturbing facet of American religion in 92 was the energy spent by the far right to make their agenda prevail in the presidential elections. Two dreadful moments stand out in my own mind. Pat Buchanan calling openly for a cultural religious war to be waged by his definition of what is right. And the Reverend Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition shocking moderate Republicans by insisting at their convention that his views of family values, homosexuality, abortion, religion, and the public schools should prevail. If you are of gentle disposition, you may wish such moments not be remembered from the pulpit, but we will be caught up in these things for years to come, and we will be dangerously blind not to inform ourselves and stay alert. Smugness is not one of the Christian graces. So you need to resist feeling smug when I refer to one of the great debates in 92, the one about the role of women in the church. We settled that issue a long time ago. Every position in a congregational church is open equally, without regard to gender. We ordained women to the ministry well over a century ago. But that decision has been harder for some. After 20 years of heated debate, the Church of England voted in November by a narrow margin to ordain women. And in immediate protest, a retired Anglican bishop of London volunteered to lead all disgruntled members out of the Church of England and into the Roman Catholic Church. A retired Episcopal bishop in Houston was elected to lead 30 churches into a new denomination that would remain free of the pernicious influence of female priests. But one has the feeling that the wall is crumbling. A woman in Hamburg, Germany, became the first female Lutheran bishop in the world, and a woman from Wisconsin, hear it carefully, Peggy, became the first female Lutheran bishop in North America. Beth Marcus became the first woman president of the Reformed Church in America. But these are news stories precisely because they are still rare. We have not yet managed to put into full practice the words of Paul that in Christ there is neither male nor female. But that will come. I was surprised last year and pleased when the Supreme Court handed down two major decisions, both by 5-4 votes, in a victory for separation of church and state. The court declared public schools may not, quote, persuade or compel a student to participate in a religious exercise, since that is forbidden by the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Mr. Bush, in response, called for a constitutional amendment to permit public school prayers, but many leaders, both secular and religious, argued that government-sponsored prayer tends to be trivialized and pro forma. And I think if you have ever watched closely what used to happen in a great many public school classrooms at such a time, you know exactly what those leaders mean. In the long run, it may be better to keep prayer private than to trivialize it by mechanical and mandated commandments. Others reminded us, very wisely it seems to me, that by upholding the wall of separation between church and state, we as a people of faith are kept from being in too cozy a relationship with government and can maintain our prophetic function, affirming what we think is good, criticizing government in the light of the eternal laws of God. I was also glad the High Court did not overturn the now 20-year-old Roe versus Wade ruling guaranteeing a woman's right to an abortion. The ruling kept in place some restrictions, but not enough to make people happy who would deny abortions for any reason at all. That battle, you may be sure, is far from over and will affect not only cities and families, but relationships between churches for a long, long time to come. And what about us, living in Wichita, worshiping on 29th Street? Most of our energies are taken up, let's face it, with simple, ordinary things, watching our health, keeping up the house, driving the kids to school and ourselves to work, walking the dog, wondering what our dreams mean, listening to the news and shaking our heads in bewilderment, marveling at the minister who says we also ought to find time for meditation and even prayer. Not much individual heroism for most of us. Small voices in an immense choir, but as part of the universal church, doing what we can for the stranger, the homeless, the misfit. And inspired from time to time by the truly heroic who do extraordinary things by an impulse of Christian faith, make costly sacrifices and risk even their lives. I want you to hear about some people like that while the new year is still fresh. On Thanksgiving Day last, the Chicago Tribune had a story about Dr. Richard Geiser. And I can only hope to be pronouncing the names right if some of the physicians listening to me know these people. His associate, Dr. Ben Bakke, and their staff at the Wheaton, Illinois Eye Clinic. I introduce them as a symbol of all who make the world a brighter place and who make it possible to keep on saying the word God without embarrassment. The story tells how half the staff of that clinic pay their own way to spend 12-hour unpaid work days caring for eyes in places like Nigeria, China, Mexico, and Afghanistan, aware that the inequity of medical care in this world is shocking. They forsake the comfort of their prosperous practices and take along donated equipment and supplies for a 2 to 6 weeks stint. One paragraph caught my eye. Traveling conditions, it said, are often less than ideal. There was, for instance, the 17-hour drive through China in an unheated bus. I talk to people who come back from vacations complaining about the jet and how its reading lights were inadequate, how the in-flight movie was one they'd already seen, and the menu wasn't up to snuff. And here's a true story of these Wheaton doctors and nurses and technicians huddled and scrunched up on hard seats in a cold bus on bad roads, bumping and bouncing along for 17 hours. My neighbor complained the other day about how cold it was in the garage when he went out in the morning to start the car. And I was annoyed by hitting the same pothole twice in 1 week. Against that petty stuff, picture this 17-hour ride to a place without running water. I have a hunch that if you looked into the eyes of the sick people waiting on those physicians, you might have been tempted to believe that the word God actually means something. And I have a hunch that the doctors would tell you that if there are better ways to live for a time in the name of God, they have not yet found them. From the Christian point of view, they are the ultimate success story. And with that word in our ears, may I pass along a definition of success, a brief program for a good life in 1993. To laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to appreciate beauty, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, to know that one life has breathed easier because you lived. This is to have succeeded. I believe it.